From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I think it is a big loss for Serb people, because he represented Serb people and was innocent of what they accused him.
Former Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic is found dead in his prison cell near The Hague. He was on trial for genocide and crimes against humanity in the wars in Croatia, Bosnia, and the fighting in Kosovo. We'll host a roundtable discussion. But first, American peace activist Tom Fox has been found dead in Iraq. He was the lone American among the four kidnapped Christian peacemaker team members. We'll speak with one of his close friends and colleagues and hear from mourners around the world.
Tom stood for a way of getting to know people that was nonviolent. He loved his friends. He loved his enemies. He reached out to the light and the humanity of everyone. And that's very important.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, the body of American peace activist Tom Fox has been found in Baghdad over 3 months after he was kidnapped along with three other members of the Christian peacemaker teams. The whereabouts of the other three hostages remains unknown. The 54-year-old Fox opposed the U.S. invasion and occupation and had traveled to Iraq to help jailed Iraqis get in touch with their families. In his final email to friends, Fox explained why he was in Iraq. He wrote, quote, "We're here to stand with those being dehumanized by oppressors and stand firm against that dehumanization. We're here to stop people, including ourselves, from dehumanizing any of God's children, no matter how much they dehumanize their own souls." In Europe, the top news today remains the death of former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. He was found dead Saturday in his prison cell in The Hague, where he was on trial for war crimes. Questions remain over how Milosevic died. An initial autopsy showed he suffered a heart attack. But earlier today, a Dutch toxicologist said unprescribed drugs have been found in his body that may have neutralized his treatment for his heart condition. Milosevic wrote a letter just a day before his death alleging he was being poisoned. The United Nations Tribunal has dismissed the poisoning speculation. We'll have more on Milosevic's death and legacy later in the program. In Chile, former political exile and political prisoner Michelle Bachelet has been inaugurated as the country's first female president. Bachelet is a single mother of three. She pledged a parity government with equal numbers of men and women in key jobs. So far, she's named 10 women and 10 men to her cabinet. Her inauguration came on the 32nd anniversary of the death of her father, who died in prison after he was arrested for treason by the Pinochet regime following the U.S.-supported 1973 coup that led to the death of President Salvador Allende. Last week, Bachelet named one of her father's cellmates, Raul Vergara Meneses, to serve as deputy defense minister for the Air Force. In the 1980s, while in exile in Nicaragua, Meneses served as commander in the Sandinista Air Force. Bachelet on Sunday vowed to unite the country.
There were times in our history that we were divided against each other. We looked at each other with suspicion. In these 16 years of democracy, we have worked together to limit the effects of a divided society, of a society that separated us. This is the moment in which we feel united.
As an agnostic, Bachelet was not actually sworn in as president, but she promised to uphold the nation's laws.
President-elect, do you promise to fulfill the position of President of the Republic, conserve the independence of the nation, and guard the Constitution and the laws?
I promise.
Michelle Bachelet, inaugurated as the first woman president of Chile. In Iraq, Sunday marked one of the bloodiest days in the country in weeks. At least 80 people were killed and nearly 250 wounded. The deadliest attack occurred in the Shiite section of Baghdad known as Sadr City, where six coordinated car bombs killed about 50 people. Meanwhile, Saturday, Amjad Hamid, a senior editor of the state-owned Al-Arqiya TV network, died after gunmen ambushed his car and shot him in the head. In Britain, an elite SAS soldier is refusing to return to fight in Iraq in what he describes as a morally wrong war of aggression. The soldier's named Ben Griffin. He's believed to be the first SAS soldier to refuse to go into combat and to leave the Army on moral grounds. Griffin said he refused to fight alongside U.S. troops because they viewed Iraqis as Untermenschen, the Nazi term for races regarded as subhuman. He also accused U.S. troops of committing dozens of illegal acts in Iraq. On Capitol Hill, Democratic Senator Russ Feingold's introducing a resolution today to censure President Bush for deliberately breaking the law by ordering the National Security Agency to conduct domestic surveillance without legally required court warrants. Feingold's resolution also accuses the president of misinforming the public about the program's existence and legality. Feingold announced his plan on Sunday on ABC's This Week.
It's an unusual step. It's a big step. But what the president did by consciously and intentionally violating the Constitution and the laws of this country with this illegal wiretapping has to be answered. There can be debate about whether the law should be changed. There can be debate about how best to fight terrorism. We all believe that there should be wiretapping in appropriate cases. But the idea that the president can just make up a law in violation of his oath of office has to be answered.
Minutes after Feingold spoke, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist appeared on the same program and said he hoped the leadership in Iran was not listening because of the terrible signal Feingold's message sent to the world about President Bush. Meanwhile, Ohio Republican Senator Mike DeWine has proposed legislation that could result in the arrest and jailing of journalists who disclose information about the government's surveillance program. The Associated Press obtained a copy of the bill, which could be introduced as soon as this week. Kate Martin, director of the Center for National Security Studies, said, quote, "The bill would make it a crime to tell the American people that the president is breaking the law, and the bill could make it a crime for newspapers to publish that fact." In Spain, charges have been dropped against three U.S. soldiers accused of shooting dead Spanish television cameraman Jose Coso in Baghdad nearly 3 years ago. In October, Spain's national court issued international arrest warrants for the three soldiers, but on Friday, the same court dropped the charges. In news on the torture scandal at Abu Ghraib, a senior staffer to a Republican Congress member has revealed he was formally reprimanded by the Army for his role in what happened at the Iraqi prison. According to Salon.com, Christopher Brinson was directly in charge of Charles Grainer and others who were later prosecuted for abuse at Abu Ghraib. Brinson now serves as deputy chief of staff for Alabama Republican Congressmember Mike Rogers. Meanwhile, an army dog handler at Abu Ghraib is going to trial today on charges he abused detainees by using unmuzzled dogs to harass, threaten, and assault detainees. Human rights attorneys hope the trial of Michael Smith will shed light on the role the military leadership played in ordering abuse at the prison. In news from Guantanamo Bay, human rights lawyers will be asking the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights today to suspend the military tribunal of a Canadian citizen who's been held at the military prison since he was 15 years old. Lawyers said Omar Khadr is the first person in modern world history to face a military commission for alleged crimes committed as a child. In news on Iran, the Boston Globe's reporting the State Department has recently opened a special office of Iranian affairs in Washington and a miniature embassy in exile in Dubai to help, quote, defeat the Iranian regime. The new office in the United Arab Emirates was set up to reach out to Iranian exiles and to help funnel money and support to dissident and anti-government activists inside and outside of Iran. The State Department's also opening Iran-specific posts in the Azerbaijan capital of Baku and in Istanbul, Frankfurt, and London, all cities with sizable populations of Iranian exiles. In Afghanistan, four people died in Kabul Sunday in a suicide car bomb targeting the head of the country's newly elected Senate. The official, Sugathullah Mojaddedi, escaped the blast with minor burns. After the attack, he blamed the Pakistani intelligence, ISI, of carrying out the assassination attempt. Also in Afghanistan, four U.S. soldiers died Sunday after a bomb hit their armored vehicle. In news from Washington, Interior Secretary Gail Norton's announced she's resigning after 5 years at her post. Norton's resignation comes shortly after her department was linked to disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff. And a former top advisor to President Bush has been arrested for shoplifting after stealing $5,000 from Target and other stores in a retail theft scheme. Claude Allen had been working as assistant to the president for domestic policy up until his unexpected resignation last month. At the time, the White House said he was resigning in order to spend more time with his family. Allen was a former aide of Senator Jesse Helm. He was seen as a rising star within the conservative movement. He now faces up to 15 years in jail for felony theft. The Independent of London is reporting Donald Rumsfeld has made over $5 million in capital gains from selling shares in the biotechnology firm that discovered and developed Tamiflu. Tamiflu is one of the few drugs believed effective in treating avian bird flu. A new financial disclosure report shows Rumsfeld holds up to $25 million worth of shares in the company Gilead Sciences. The Pentagon has defended Rumsfeld's holdings, stating he has no relationship with the Gilead Sciences beyond his investments in the company. At the University of Miami, striking janitors are entering their second week on the picket line in an effort to secure a living wage and better health care. The striking workers are all employees of the Boston-based Unico Services. The workers, who are mostly Haitian and Cuban immigrants, earn on average about $7 an hour without health care benefits. While the janitors are officially employed by Unico, University of Miami President Donna Shalala has also been criticized for her lack of role in the dispute. Shalala served as President Clinton's Secretary for Health and Human Services. In 2001, she lamented about her failure in providing, quote, health insurance for everybody. In environmental news, up to 267,000 gallons of crude oil has leaked from a pipeline in northern Alaska. Officials say it's the largest oil spill ever in Alaska's North Slope. The Campus Anti-War Network is calling on supporters to phone New York's Pace University today in order to request charges be dropped against two student activists. The students, Brian Kelly and Lauren Giacone, say the university is threatening to expel them for distributing flyers and for protesting without a permit. The charges were filed after the two students called Bill Clinton a war criminal during his speech at the school last week. After being removed from the speech, the students said they were detained, searched, and questioned by law enforcement and Secret Service agents. And Iraqi war resistors Pablo Paredes, Camila Mejia, and Aiden Delgado, as well as Fernando Suarez del Solar, whose son was killed in Iraq, have begun a 241-mile march for peace from Tijuana, Mexico, to San Francisco. The march is inspired by Gandhi's 1930 Salt March protesting British imperialism. Historian Howard Zinn said, quote, "This is one of the most significant actions taken yet to dramatize the movement against the war, especially because it calls attention to the Latino population, the loss of Latino life in the war, and the unrecognized Latino opposition to the war," Zinn said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, reporting from New York. Tom Fox, the lone American among the four Christian Peacemaker team members kidnapped in Iraq, has been found dead. Iraqi police said his body was discovered in Baghdad Thursday with gunshot wounds to the head and chest. There were conflicting reports over whether he also showed signs of having been tortured. Police officials quoted by several news agencies said bruises on his body appeared to be inflicted by electrical cables. But an anonymous police official told the Washington Post that Fox showed no signs of torture. Tom Fox was 54 years old. He came to Iraq with the Christian Peacemaker Teams, a non-missionary organization that's been documenting the abuse of Iraqi detainees, working with the families of prisoners and promoting peace. The CPT were the first to publicly denounce the torture of Iraqi people at the hands of U.S. forces long before the media revealed what was happening at Abu Ghraib. Fox and three others, Harmeet Sudan and Jim Loney, both of Canada, and Norman Kember of Britain, were abducted in November. Last week, Al Jazeera broadcast the first video of the hostages seen in a month. The footage included the three others, but not Tom Fox. The kidnappers have made repeated threats on the peacemakers' lives unless all prisoners in U.S. and Iraqi detention centers are released. According to Newsweek, 45 kidnapped foreigners, including 14 U.S. citizens, remain missing in Iraq. 430 foreigners have been kidnapped in Iraq since the U.S.-led invasion. At least 54 of them have been executed by their captors. Meanwhile, Newsweek reports Iraqis are kidnapped at a rate of 10 to 30 people per day. From the United States to Iraq, Tom Fox was remembered as a dedicated Christian pacifist who devoted his life to peace. This is Christian Peacemaker Teams member Donna Hicks.
Another way than violence and war. Tom stood for a way of getting to know people that was nonviolent. He loved his friends, he loved his enemies. He reached out to the light and the humanity of everyone, and that's very important.
Donna Hicks, a member of the Christian Peacemaker Teams. Chris Chupp, Christian Peacemakers Coordinator, also addressed the loss.
As an organization and as friends of Tom, with those Iraqi families who have suffered this kind of loss on a daily basis for 3 years and before.
In Iraq, mourners gathered in Baghdad after the announcement of Tom Fox's death. This is one Baghdad resident.
As an Iraqi people, we totally reject all the justification given for the killing of those people who are here for purely humanitarian reasons. Therefore, we reject the killings of those people from a humanitarian point of view, and as Muslims too, we reject this heinous act.
That was Abu Hassanin al-Khaisi in Baghdad. Tom Fox's longtime friend Isabella Bates was among those who gathered at Langley Hill Friends Meeting in McLean, the Quaker community in Virginia, where Fox had been a member for many years. Bates read aloud words Tom Fox wrote about his mission in Iraq.
Tom wrote this statement along with another member of the Christian Peacemakers team, Matthew Chandler. I can only hope that Tom knew in some measure in his heart that this statement that he made as a solitary human being ignited the prayers of literally millions of people around the world who have been praying with him and for him during these 100 days. Just even today, we have received messages of prayers from Australia, from Germany, from England. The amplification of his work goes forward, but here's where it began. October 7, 2004, statement of conviction. We members of Christian Peacemakers teams in Iraq are aware of the many risks both Iraqis and internationals currently face. However, we are convinced at this time that the risks, while significant, do not outweigh our purpose in remaining. Many Iraqi friends and human rights workers have welcomed us as nonviolent, independent presence. During the previous year, they asked us to tell their stories, since they could not easily be heard, nor could most flee to a safer country. We continue to act as a resource to connect citizens of Iraq with human rights organizations, both local and international, as well as accompanying them as they interact with the multinational military personnel and Iraqi provisional government officials. As peacemaking team, we need to cross boundaries, help soldiers and other armed actors be humane, and invite them to refuse unjust orders. We need to help preserve what is human in all of us, and so offer glimpses of hope in a dark time. We reject kidnapping and hostage taking wholesale. If any of us are taken hostage, absolutely no ransom will be paid. In such an event, CPT will attempt to communicate with the hostage takers or their sponsors and work against journalists' inclinations to vilify and demonize the offenders. We will try to understand the motives of these actions and to articulate them, while maintaining a firm stance that such actions are wrong. If appropriate, CPT will work with diplomatic officials from our representative governments to avoid a violent outcome. We reject the use of violent force to save our lives should we be kidnapped, held hostage, or caught in the middle of violent conflict situation. We also reject violence to punish anyone who harms us. We ask for equal justice in the arrest and trial of anyone, soldier or civilian, who commits an act of violence, and we ask that there be no retaliation on their relatives or property. We forgive those who consider us their enemies. Therefore, any penalty should be in the spirit of restorative justice rather than in the form of violent retribution. We hope that in loving both friends and enemies, and by intervening nonviolently to aid those who are systematically oppressed, we can contribute in some small way to transforming this volatile situation. Tom Fox and Matthew Chandler.
Isabella Bates, longtime friend of Tom Fox in Virginia this weekend. We are going to break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Michelle Nahr-Obed, a member of the Christian Peacemakers team. She just recently returned from 2 months in Iraq. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand? Freedom or our comfort and convenience? Is it to profit for big business we pledge our allegiance? Are we prisoners in the land of the brave and the bold, held by indifference or hearts grown hard and cold? And proved
Sarah Thompson. Is it for freedom? Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we remember the life of Tom Fox with Michelle Nahr-Obed, she's a member of the Christian Peacemaker teams, a friend and colleague of Tom Fox. She just returned from 2 months in Iraq. She joins us on the line from Duluth, Minnesota. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michelle.
Thank you, Amy. Thanks for having me.
First of all, our condolences on your loss, on the loss of the Christian Peacemakers team, on the death of Tom Fox.
Yeah, thank you. It's a big loss to the whole world, his life.
We received your email this weekend that said, "We mourn and we carry on." Can you talk about Tom?
Sure. I met Tom the first time in 2004, and he was training to be a CPT full-time member. And part of the training involved doing some nonviolent actions, one of which was at the Navy ELF site in Wisconsin. So Tom and I were arrested together at that training, and he was an incredible presence, you know, very soft-spoken, but his his spirit just exuded strength and centeredness, and he was committed to nonviolence. He was committed to trying to create a world in which violence would not dominate as it does right now.
Can you talk about your 2 months in Iraq? This was the period that your four colleagues had been kidnapped, what you were doing each day. Three of them we have seen on a videotape, of course, desperately hope they are still alive. Can you talk about what you were doing in Iraq?
Sure. I went back to Iraq. This was my fourth trip. I got there just about a month after they had been taken. I got there early January. So at the time, during the 2 months that I've been there, we did quite a few different projects, one of which is that we would try to have some form of communication with those that were holding our friends, and we did that through our appeals that we sent out over our website. We put out press releases in the Arab media. We had lots of Iraqi friends and friends throughout the Muslim communities that would help put out these appeals in hopes that we would reach the hearts and minds of those that were holding the three now and that were holding the four at the time. It was often a one-way kind of monologue. We never really were able to make contact. They never made contact with us, but we continued in putting out those appeals. That was one thing that we did in relation to our four colleagues. In terms of other projects there, we had a number of things going on, including continuing the following up of detainees, particularly now as detainees are being shifted from the multinational force prisons into the Iraqi prisons, but still with the Americans, the U.S. military advisors very much behind the scenes controlling the movement of prisoners. The very scary thing is that there are no oversights in the Iraqi prisons. Like, I've spoken with somebody from the International Red Cross who says they have no access right now to the Iraqi prisons. We spoke with somebody from the Red Crescent. They also have no access to the Iraqi prisons, and we have all heard of reports of death squads and torture happening within these prisons, and we also know that there were two U.S. military advisors working within the Ministry of Interior that are very well trained in counterinsurgency and had worked a very long time in Central and South America. So they are behind the scenes, but there aren't any of these oversights. So we would actually try to go to prisons. As team members, we would go. We would never get very far. We would get basically as far as the security commander, and at least try to find out if people were held there that whose family members asked us to look for their loved ones. And so we did projects like that. We right now the Palestinians are experiencing a lot of violence and pressure, and we've heard reports that they've been are being asked to or being told to leave the country en masse, and so we've been trying to connect them with people within the UN, some of the other embassies, and people are organizing to leave the country and asking for CPT to accompany them to a border where they have a shot of maybe getting out of the country. So that project was in the making. The biggest project, I think, was probably we were developing and being part of the development of coalition of human rights, Iraqi human rights groups that were across the sectarian divide. So we include Kurds and Christian Iraqi Christians and Sunni and Shia. And we were trying to build this so that everybody would be included, that there's a desperate groundswell of people to develop a decent and good country that would be part of the world community. And these people are the ones that are doing this, and we've been working with them. And that's just incredibly inspiring that under these horrendous conditions that people would come out to do that and work with each other. So CPT was part of that as well.
We're talking to Michelle Nahr-Obed, a member of the Christian Peacemaker Team's new Tom Fox. His body was revealed to the public that he was killed on Friday night, but I understand that you all knew on Thursday. There's a dispute over whether his body showed signs of torture, Michelle. We know he was shot repeatedly in the head. Some reports of electrical cord that he was of marks of electrical cords. The Washington Post quoting a police official saying that wasn't true. What do you know?
I don't really know anything in terms of definitive answers to that. I've heard the same conflicting reports. We had asked repeatedly that, you know, in the event that any of them were killed and their bodies were found and they went and they were taken into the into government custody, that CPT would be allowed to view the body and accompany their bodies back home, and we were totally excluded from that when Tom's body was discovered. We tried to get them to stand with the decision that they would allow one of our members to accompany his body home. One of our team members got to the point of where his casket was being loaded onto the plane, but she was denied the ability to fly home with Tom. So none of us got to see his body. None of us, we've all got the same conflicting reports. There are two people that are waiting for Tom's body in Dover. They'll be standing vigil. Ann Montgomery and Rich Meyer are standing vigil waiting for his body to come in. And in terms of the autopsy reports that come out, it will be, I think, up to the family to, you know, to ask for those reports. I don't think that CPT has the has the ability to do that. So that's as much as I know. I do know that his body, his casket was lined up right next to an Iraqi detainee casket on the plane, and Doug Pritchard, our team coordinator, wrote a beautiful reflection on the beginning of Tom's journey home, and he's described as accompanying an Iraqi detainee with caskets next to each other.
An Iraqi detainee who died in custody?
I think, yes, if they were part of the Iraqi police or the Iraqi National Guard, their bodies might be, I don't know where their body was being transferred to, but that some of the Iraqi National Guards, when they're injured, are treated with the multinational force injured fighters.
And now, Michelle, what are you doing? What is the Christian Peacemaker Teams doing about the three men who were left? We just came back from our week's broadcast in London, and there was a lot of attention on Norman Kember, the man from Britain who is part of CPT. It was the 100 days anniversary. There were vigils, much more so than in this country. We saw all day on television the friends and the colleagues of Norman Kember talking about their work in prison. This, of course, before the body of Tom Fox turned up. What are you doing at this point, and is there any word?
Yeah, in terms of what people are doing for our three colleagues that are still missing, again, it's a continuous appeal via our website and via the Arab and Muslim communities appealing to the sanity and compassion and decency that exists in every single human being, including those that are holding the three. They have the same human, compassionate heart that we all have, and to appeal to that, for them to release them to their families and friends. And so those appeals will continue out over the airwaves and the written word throughout Iraq. And in terms of different vigils and gatherings here, there are an incredible amount of vigils and gatherings. It's just that we don't have the same, except for media representatives like you and some of the other independent media, we don't have the same kind of attention drawing that together and letting the world see that the values that we still stand for, the values that Tom stood for, the values that the three that are still Jim and Norman and Harmeet, that they still stand for. We don't have the same kind of media coverage of that, but believe me, it's going on all over the world, and we'll have one here in Duluth. Gene Stolz, who used to be the director of CPT, has called, and he and his wife will definitely want to be part of something here in Duluth. They're only a couple of hours away north of us. So,
well, Michelle Norobid, we want to thank you very much for being with us. And, of course, on our website, democracynow.org, we have the reading of Tom's last letter about why he is in Iraq. And we will link to CPT website and other relevant information at democracynow.org. And, of course, for our radio listeners, you can see the images of Tom Fox, the pictures, and the people remembering him at democracynow.org. Michelle Norobid speaking to us from Duluth. As we turn now to the story of the weekend of the death of Slobodan Milosevic, the former Serbian leader found dead in his prison cell Saturday at The Hague. The cause of death was reported as a heart attack. This is Alexandra Milanov, a spokesperson for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia.
The tribunal has received a brief summary of the autopsy results. According to the pathologists, Slobodan Milosevic's cause of death was a myocardial infarction. Further, the pathologists identified two heart conditions that Slobodan Milosevic suffered from, which they said would explain the myocardial infarction. The prosecution service of The Hague informed the registrar that a toxicological examination will still be carried out. The tribunal has been informed that the final report will be issued as soon as possible. Slobodan Milosevic's remains will be released to the family tomorrow.
Slobodan Milosevic had been charged with genocide and crimes against humanity in a number of indictments spanning from the wars in Croatia and Bosnia to the fighting in Kosovo. His trial was in its fourth year. Prosecutors called nearly 300 witnesses. The former Serbian leader chose to represent himself at the trial. His death comes just weeks after he'd called on former President Bill Clinton to testify. Clinton, who with British Prime Minister Tony Blair led the NATO bombings of Kosovo and Yugoslavia, declined to appear. As news of Milosevic's death spread across the world, some of his victims said the jailed ex-Serbian leader had escaped justice. This is a survivor of the 1995 Srebrenica massacre.
We are interested only in justice. We know the truth. All those responsible for the crimes should go to The Hague, even if they never come back. Slobodan Milosevic didn't deserve to die so easily. We are sorry that he died so easily.
A survivor of the 1995 Srebrenica massacre. Meanwhile, some of Milosevic's supporters are claiming he was poisoned. Zdenko Tomanovic, Milosevic's attorney, cited a letter he said the former Serbian leader wrote just one day before his death.
He had received a new document only a few days ago, which it could be clear be seen that on January 12th this year, there had been found a strong drug in his bloodstream, which, as it was stated in the report, is used only for the treatment of leprosy and tuberculosis. Mr. Milosevic pointed out also in his letter that they would like to poison me. And he was serious concerned, and he was serious worried that he was being poisoned.
Milosevic's attorney. His supporters also cited a medical report that found traces in his system of drugs that would have offset pills he's been taking for high blood pressure. The UN dismissed speculation Milosevic had been deliberately poisoned. Hague officials involved in his prosecution said Milosevic had a history of manipulating his own health and taking unprescribed medication. After break, we go to our three guests who know the Balkan region well. We'll be joined by Andrej Grubacic, who is formerly from Belgrade, now a historian currently studying at SUNY Binghamton. We'll also be joined by Chris Hedges, foreign correspondent for the New York Times until recently, now a senior fellow at the Nation Institute, covered the Balkans for a number of years, including the NATO bombings in 1999, and wrote the book War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and Losing Moses on the Freeway, talking to us from Princeton. And we'll be joined by Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent, independent journalist, currently the Puffin Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute, also covered the NATO bombings of Kosovo and Yugoslavia for Democracy Now! In 1999. His current article is available at antiwar.com. Rest easy, Bill Clinton. Milosevic can't talk anymore. He's going to speak to us from Sacramento. All this after break. John Fahey here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're going to begin on the death of Slobodan Milosevic with Andrej Grubacic, originally from Belgrade, now here in the United States. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Can you talk about the death of Milosevic and his incomplete trial?
I don't know enough. I would be a little bit more careful with what really happened with poisoning. We don't know anything about this as yet, to be certain. I would be careful, but I do think that this was a case of gradual poisoning of Milosevic. Not gradual poisoning, but gradual attempts to get rid of Milosevic. He obviously didn't have proper medicine and proper medical care.
And the fact that his trial was not complete, moving into the last perhaps 40 hours of the trial.
That was a blessing. That was, as your colleague Jeremy Scahill wrote, that's a blessing for Bill Clinton, first and foremost. It's not a victory of justice to have Milosevic died dead in The Hague. I think the things are extremely complicated. We need to speak about them in context, and Milosevic has to be understood in the context of his own reign, in his own rule in Yugoslavia, and we can talk a little bit more about this. I think that as for the Hague Tribunal, I think this was an ideal situation. Milosevic became too expensive and he became too damaging for the image of the tribunal.
And his history as the leader of Serbia?
His history of leader of Serbia, I would be more careful. He was never a leader of Serbia. He was a leader of a certain fraction of Serbian population, of 20% of the electorate of Serbia who voted him. He was never really authoritarian dictator as he was presented, but he was not a leader of Serbia.
Chris Hedges, you cover the NATO bombings, have written extensively about the Balkans. Your response to the death of Slobodan Milosevic?
Well, it does rob us of a process of, exposing the whole complicated mess of the war and the complicity, of course, of or the tacit complicity of the European Union and the United States, which failed to respond for 3.5 years to these crimes against humanity and this campaign of ethnic cleansing or genocide that was carried out largely, primarily against the Bosnian Muslims. It is a tragedy that he's gone. He did have serious health problems, and it is true that he not only tried to be his own lawyer, but tried to be his own doctor. So I wouldn't jump to hasty conclusions about how he died yet. I mean, we'll have to wait for the toxicology report. I think the other thing is that I feel that Milosevic, certainly at the beginning of his reign, did have very wide support, not only within Serbia, but within ethnic Serb populations in Croatia and within Bosnia. I mean, this may have soured over time, but I'd be a little hesitant not to call him a leader of Serbia. I think that this sort of nationalism and euphoria over a greater Serbia was very real, and certainly many elements of Serbian society, including much of the Serbian press, got right behind him and served as essentially served as propaganda for this nationalist Serb movement. This was part of the problem, that Milosevic was able, through his Serbian allies, to take over the airwaves and pump forth this sort of vitriol and hate propaganda against other ethnic groups. It took him 4 years, by the way, of spewing out this hatred before he got one Serb, which happened to be Arkan, to cross the border and begin the campaign of killing. But there was complicity in this project by many elements of Serb society.
Jeremy Scahill, you wrote the piece this weekend, Rest Easy, Bill Clinton, Milosevic Can't Talk Anymore. Explain.
I think that there are sort of two lenses through which we have to look at Milosevic. On the one hand, we have the war in Bosnia that Chris Hedges was just talking about. And I think Milosevic has an extraordinarily interesting history, particularly with the United States, because as Chris could well tell you, there were points, sustained points, during the 1990s when the White House used Slobodan Milosevic as the key to peace. He comes to the United States, his wife goes out and goes shopping with U.S. officials as they're in the midst of these negotiations. He was very much embraced as sort of one of our kind of guys, so to speak, you know, an investment banker. He had worked in the United States. He speaks English. And so the U.S. viewed Milosevic in a very favorable way. It's a classic story that's repeated itself through the history of the United States, where they embrace these guys that later then they vilify and make out to be the equivalent of Hitler, which Milosevic, like Saddam Hussein, was compared to Hitler many times by the United States. So you have this Slobodan Milosevic during the 1990s, who is a friend of the United States and then very quickly turns into the sort of chief villain in the war. And once they had declared Milosevic the chief villain in the war, the plight of the Serbs became almost a non-story. The single greatest ethnic cleansing of the war, according to the New York Times, was in August of 1995, Operation Storm and Lightning, where upwards of 250,000 Serbs were expelled by the Croatian military in a matter of days from the Krajina region. So that though largely went fell on deaf ears, and I'll forever remember that long, massive column of tens of thousands of Serbs having to flee their homes at the hands of the Croatian military. And so there's really an unfortunate reality that's happened. As soon as Milosevic became Hitler, that then meant that the Serb victims became somehow less important than the others in the war. The other story that's very important, and I think you can get the Slobodan Milosevic Butcher of the Balkans story by reading any of his obituaries, by reading any of the coverage. So what I want to try to do is to paint a picture that gets into some of what hasn't been discussed and isn't going to be discussed. It wasn't discussed in Milosevic's life, and it's not going to be discussed in his death. The fact of the matter is that an incredible number of Serbs suffered as a result of that war and of Milosevic's policies as well. And so you had a situation where Milosevic had been discredited, and so when he started to talk to the world about the fact that you had Al-Qaeda and Mujahideen turning their sights on Bosnia after the defeat of the Soviets in Afghanistan, and that you had scores of these Mujahideen setting up camp in Bosnia to fight the Orthodox Serbs and the Catholic Croatians, no one was really listening to Milosevic. And the fact of the matter was that the United States was on the same side as those same forces in Bosnia that it was on in Afghanistan as well. They were organizing funding conferences for the Bosnian Muslims and working hand-in-hand with the very forces that would go on to attack the United States, allegedly, on 9/11. And Slobodan Milosevic was consistently trying to bring that to the attention of the United States, to the point where you had over 1,000 Mujahideen who were given honorary Bosnian citizenship following the disintegration war of Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Well, then fast forward a bit to 1998, Richard Holbrooke, Bill Clinton's envoy and eventual United Nations ambassador, goes and he meets with senior officials in Belgrade. He likes to boast that he was the U.S. official, that the Western official that met the most with Slobodan Milosevic. Well, Slobodan Milosevic and other Serb officials told Richard Holbrooke and presented him with the evidence that they had that Osama bin Laden was influencing the Kosovo Liberation Army. And in fact, senior U.S. officials had already determined the Kosovo Liberation Army to be a terrorist organization. And so Milosevic was very consistent with what U.S. information was at the time. But Richard Holbrooke and others were very key in this decision for the United States to really fund and arm the Kosovo Liberation Army. And Milosevic, by the time his trial came around and he was talking about this, he sounded as though he was just sort of a political opportunist talking about 9/11, talking about terrorists and Mujahideen, when actually for quite a long time, Slobodan Milosevic was raising these issues. And so one of the things that dies or gets buried with Slobodan Milosevic is this chance to raise some of the crimes of the United States, but also the role the United States played in boosting up some very unsavory characters in that region, not the least of which is the current is the new Prime Minister of Kosovo, a general by the name of Agim Čeku. Amy, we've done reporting on him before. He was one of the leaders of Operation Storm and Lightning in Croatia that expelled upwards of 250,000 Serbs. Also has was one of the leaders of an organization in Kosovo that functioned like a death squad. He now is going to be the Prime Minister of Kosovo, and he quite possibly could be indicted as well by The Hague, but we won't know. Milosevic certainly was going to raise his role, and it's a very ominous fact that Agim Čeku is the Prime Minister of Kosovo, because this is a man who has led a campaign to expel Serbs, Romas, and other minorities. So much for the humanitarian intervention of Bill Clinton.
Jeremy, we want to go to a clip now from Richard Holbrooke, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations during the NATO bombings of Kosovo and Yugoslavia. This was his reaction to Milosevic's death.
I was kind of astonished. This is somebody I knew very well. But I think that justice was served. He spent the last 5 years of his life in jail. I never thought he would be a free man again. I didn't think he should be. He started four wars. He wrecked southeastern Europe. Over 300,000 people died, over 2.5 million homeless because of Milosevic. And he paid the price. And although he won't serve out many years in jail, he paid the price by ending his life in jail.
Richard Holbrooke, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations during the NATO bombings, Kosovo and Yugoslavia. Chris Hedges, your response.
I just want to comment a little bit on what was said before. There certainly was Mujahideen in Bosnia. I actually went into one of their camps and interviewed them, but I think they were a pretty minor force. I don't want to lose sight of the fact that 90-plus percent of the victims of the war, the people who were killed, were Bosnian Muslims. This does not in any way excuse the terrible suffering that many Serbs endured, including in Operation Storm, the most effective ethnic cleansing in the entire Balkan for the entire wars of former Yugoslavia was indeed carried out by Croatia. But the worst suffering was really meted out towards the Muslims. I think also on Kosovo, it's the Albanian security service that pick Thaci up. I knew him when he was just a sort of local thug in a province called Drenica, driving around an old Zastava with a trunkload of weapons, oversaw the assassination of most of his rivals and provided him not only with weapons, but a small black army of Albanian intelligence officers, not only to protect him, but help organize and raise this fractious rebellion. That we know as the Kosovo Liberation Army. So there were many hands in there. I think that the United States, it is very true that the United States, especially when there was a rift between Slobodan Milosevic and Radovan Karadzic and the Bosnian Serbs, certainly empowered Milosevic and used him as a way to force the Bosnian Serbs to bend towards U.S. will, especially, of course, at Dayton, but at many other times, such as the taking of the hostages of the UN peacekeepers, getting them freed and this kind of stuff. It is a messy, complicated game. And I think it's probably when the history of the Clinton administration is written, it's Bill Clinton's greatest moral failing, as well as, of course, failing as in terms of foreign policy. Remember that when the Holocaust Museum was dedicated shortly before Clinton took office, Elie Wiesel got up and spoke about Bosnia, because, of course, Wiesel understands the lessons of the Holocaust, which is that when you have the capacity to stop a campaign of genocide and you do not, you are culpable in some way for that genocide. And that was something that, on an intellectual level, Bill Clinton knew and understood. Yet for 3.5 years, he never had the spine. He would not stand up to the Pentagon, to Colin Powell, and react. And it went on and on and on. I think the other important point to remember of the wars in the Balkans is that, unfortunately, it gave us this policy which was embraced by many, sort of liberal interventionists, of humanitarian intervention. And this idea was used to justify the war in Iraq, and it very much came out of the interventions in Bosnia and Kosovo, although the situations were very different. Those were active campaigns of genocide. The campaigns of genocide that had taken place in Iraq against the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north by Saddam Hussein were largely over. But I think that that is also another legacy of the war that was manipulated and used to get many people on the left and essentially silence dissidents or people who might have been critics, and bring them into the huge shout fest that took place leading up to the invasion of Iraq.
I want to ask our guest in studio, Andrei Grubicic, about Mladic and Karadzic. Still, they are free.
They're still free.
But I wanted to just get a quick response from Jeremy Scahill to Chris Hedges.
I think Chris Hedges really hits it on the head when he talks about the Clinton's model for military humanism being applied in Iraq. There are many similarities in between what Clinton did in Yugoslavia and what Bush has done in Iraq. One of the top among them is the fact that Clinton scoffed at the international community. He refused to get United Nations authorization and instead went with a NATO alliance attack on Yugoslavia. The other fact that is painful is that the Clinton administration is deeply implicated in the campaign of ethnic violence and killing that happened in Kosovo. Because, Amy, when I was on the ground in Kosovo interviewing Albanians, they said that life was horrible under Slobodan Milosevic, and there were all sorts of killings and disappearances and systematic human rights abuses, but that the real water happened once NATO started bombing, once the United States started hitting Kosovo. It gave cover for paramilitary forces to move in and take out whole villages of people. I also interviewed several Serbian special forces guys as well as regular army guys who described the same thing, that a week into the bombing, 2 weeks into the bombing, which began 7 years ago this month, that's when the ethnic targeting really began.
Jeremy, we only have 30 seconds, and I want to go back to Andrei Grubicic on the issue of Karadzic and Mladic being captured or now free.
They are not captured. They are still free, both Mladic and Karadzic. Ratko Mladic is a general, a Bosnian general, was a leading commander of Bosnian army. Radovan Karadzic was a political leader of Bosnian
Where are
Serbs.
They?
They're hiding. They're hiding. They are. I don't have any sympathies for neither for Mladic nor for Karadzic, but I have even less sympathy for the way that they're being treated and hunted like animals.
On that note, we'll have to leave it there. Jeremy Scahill will be speaking on Tuesday night with Dar Jamal at the First Methodist Church, Tuesday night in Sacramento, talking about Iraq, the story corporate media won't tell you. You can go to wethemedia.tv for more information. And Andrei Grubicic will be speaking in New York at City Space.
New Space
here in New York City on Thursday night. And we'll link to both of those events at our website, democracynow.org. Chris Hedges, journalist and author of War's Force That Gives Us Meaning. And Losing Moses on the Freeway. DemocracyNow.org is produced by Mike Berkshire, for Dokadoosh, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Ruba Rich, and Maddie Harper. Aaron Maté, happy birthday to Aaron Maté. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.